time to tell me the truth, to burden your mouth for what you say, no pieces of paper in the way, 'cause I can't continue pretending to choose these opposite sides on which we fall, loving you later as if at all.
Welcome to Between the Lines, a monthly magazine show on the third Thursday of every month at 2 p.m. I'm your host, Anne Forbes Cooper. My first guest today is Art Murphy, a fine arts photographer who specializes in fossils. That's Devonian fossils from over 350 million years ago. He has a solo exhibition coming up at the Museum of Natural History in Florence, Italy. And my second guest is Nina Skalansky, who is the brains and creative talent behind a new website and marketing campaign to promote Catskill. But first up, here's Art Murphy.
I want to start with saying I actually really love what you do. It's just an extraordinary use of fossils, I think. You kind of I was going through your gallery today and you kind of juxtapose them with other found objects, and you use light and you use colour, and they're just really beautiful, and it's hard to sort of describe what they're actually like on the radio. What was it that got you started? What was it that initially interested you in fossils? And we're talking, first of all, about invertebrate fossils, right?
Yes, marine invertebrate fossils, and thank you very much for the kind words. What got me started was I happened to find some outside my studio, and you know, I guess they just happened to hit me at a certain point in time. I had been working on another project which was more architectural, and I was probably looking around for somewhere else to go. You know, you just kind of move from one project to the next. And I discovered these and I saw how wonderful they were, just visually. They were worthy of further pursuit. And I discovered that, lo and behold, my little cabin studio in the woods here sits atop a tremendous plethora of marine invertebrate fossils. They're Devonian fossils.
Which we should just explain exactly what Devonian fossils are. First of all, the name comes from Devon in England, right?
Yes, it does. And let me issue a caveat from the start. I'm a photographer and not a scientist. And much as I study this geology and paleontology now and try to immerse myself in it, I fall woefully short. And I do have well-equipped professionals who I turn to for advice on identification and the like. The Devonian period, the particular stones and fossils that exist here are from roughly about 385 million years old. And quite frankly, that in and of itself was enough to intrigue me. The fact that they were once living beings, such a tremendously distant time in the past, an incomprehensible time, if you will, just really grabbed me. And add to that the fact that they have an intrinsic natural beauty. They just really kind of stunned me, and I became pretty obsessed with them. And I just began photographing them. I tried to give them their due, so to speak. I unearthed something that hadn't been seen in however many millions and millions and millions of years, and they just deserved a rich romantic sort of a treatment. At least that's how I envisioned it. What's happened over the course of time is that it turned out to be a project that we all really dream of having, because after a while they start kind of speaking to you. You know, they start telling you which way to go. And I've had a number of side trips where they kind of lead me. One of the things that you referred to was the juxtaposition with other objects. That is part of what I call my Devonian drawer series. I found an old, rusted out metal drawer that I fell in love with. It was from an industrial file cabinet or something like that. And, you know, it just had age. It had more modern age, but it had age and wear. And I started to see how interesting it was to juxtapose the extreme age of the fossils with the textures and rusted out elements of the drawer. At the same time, I started to put them together with other various objects that I would come across, some of which had a very direct meaning or relationship, some of which maybe is a lot more elusive. And so rather than think too hard about it, and without trying to be cute in matching the objects and the fossils together, this other project has grown. And it's one of the ongoing side trips that keep me going with the fossils.
I was just going to say, because we're kind of sitting in what was a sea. This was the Catskill Sea at one point.
We're on what I gather was the eastern edge of an inland sea that stretched all the way out to Ohio. And so as a result, a lot of the fossils that we find here are, well, mostly are marine invertebrate. A little bit further down the road, there's a whole variety of corals and things like that. But yes, this is a very dense area. It's an endless wonder. Every time I go out into the woods, it becomes a great little adventure. So the working with the fossils is very different from any of the projects that I've worked on in the past, in that there's a whole process involved. And a very big part of the process, quite frankly, is excuse me, being alone and out in the woods and the quarries, walking the stream beds. You know, a great reason to be out there looking around and searching for rocks. And it's kind of like going fishing. You know, if you don't catch a fish while you're out, you sure had a good time and life made a whole lot of sense.
We are just off the High Falls Road and surrounded by trees and streams, the mm-hmm. creek, Catterson, the Catterskill Creek, yeah. And also a beaver dam.
Yeah, it's just a wonderful bit of nature here. The Hudson River painters, I discovered through some research, of course, walked all through this area. I'm sure they walked this creek and many of the others. They had also been involved in the study of geology to some degree. Part of the mantra of that movement was the need to depict nature in a complete accuracy, all for the greater wonder and glory of God, if I recall correctly, something along those
lines. Yeah, something like that.
Something like that. And so they really they took that very seriously. So, for instance, a tree, when they painted a tree, was not just a tree. It was a poplar, or it was an oak, or it was a walnut. And the same held true for the geology of the area, because that's so important in the establishment of a proper landscape image. And so a rock was not just a rock. A rock was sandstone or bluestone or this or that. So they had a concern for accuracy. It so happened at roughly the same time when they began, I guess, in the 1820s, 1830s, gentlemen geologists existed throughout this area. And this was an area where a lot of the early geological developments occurred before geology was formally recognized as a science. And many of those geologists hiked these same areas. And there's evidence that the painters went out into the woods with the geologists, helping on their expeditions and also using it as an opportunity to draw and also to collect some fossils. In fact, I did this project a couple of years ago where I managed to photograph fossils that were collected by Thomas Cole himself. His son was a huge collector. Asher Durand has wonderful recollections of running down to the stream in Palinville early in the morning to go looking for fossils. So it all kind of wrapped together, and it's a very interesting little sidelight to it all.
What's interesting also, I think, is that what Bob Titus pointed out, who's the Bob being the Catskill geologist, yes. What he pointed out about your work was that
It's not that these fossils are really any great finds, geologically speaking, but it's what you do with them that is so very interesting.
Yeah, that's a very nice compliment. I mean, it was a funny way to put it. He referred to them as fairly mundane. I wouldn't bother to pick them up. But I don't see them that way. Without sounding too silly about it, one of my favorites, who I have always enjoyed reading, was Studs Terkel, mm-hmm. who wrote Working and wrote about the common man and just wrote glorious things about the everyday life and struggle of people. And in a funny sort of way, I kind of liken that to what I do with the fossils. You could go to a museum and see fossils that have been prepped and worked on for endless hours, and they look absolutely perfect. And I do enjoy photographing them. That's another little side light that I've gotten into, photographing some museum collections. But what I really enjoy most is getting dirt under my fingernails and digging around and coming up with something that doesn't look perfect at all. But in fact, part of its beauty lies in that more natural state. So I don't get too careful about brushing them, and I kind of like them in the raw. And they, like I say, we have a little dialogue going once I bring them home.
The other thing is that, of course, you use quite a lot of digital techniques on them. So what exactly do they go through? I mean, what constitutes a photograph for you? What do you put them through?
Well, first of all, I'm not even exactly sure what these titles mean anymore. I mean, I've been a photographer my whole career. I was also a retoucher for a while, where I learned a lot of the really best Photoshop techniques that I've been able to employ. I was also a painter, so the combination of the two really go hand in glove. I am not concerned if you call what I do photography or not photography. I think we're kind of past really even concerning ourselves with that. The camera and the computer are tools that we use to create images. I oftentimes wonder, well, you know, what would Da Vinci have done with an iPad? I don't think he would have been bored with it. I think he would have found things to do that we can't even imagine. So it's just a matter of swapping out the tools that technology provide for us. If this were 150 years ago, I'd probably be out with a sketchbook and a pencil, drawing pictures of the fossils. But now I have a different way of doing it. As far as my particular process, for me at least, gone is the, the decisive moment. Cartier-Bresson always talked about that in photography, that moment, that instant when you click the shutter. Well, in documentary work and journalistic work, I can see where that's still important, but for me, it's not. When I go out and shoot, whether it's here in my studio or out in the woods or in a quarry or wherever, snapping the shutter is really only the first step in a process. I know what I'm looking for. I know what I can do with that image that I create at that point. But the process is not done until I put it through a number of other steps. With the fossils, I very rarely, if ever, do any major retouching or anything like that other than a little cleanup. But the beauty of the digital darkroom, as it had been come to be known, it just gives me incredible control. And so what I wind up doing to that initial image is to kind of give it life and just really take it somewhere else. But I guess I struggle for the words on this. Yeah. Got me. I just do what I do and, you know, we see what happens. I have a good time doing it. It's really the biggest concern of mine is that I could just explore these objects and see where they go. They have this magical quality to them, and that's what kind of keeps me interested. So I'm always looking for new places. I always love hearing someone say, "Oh, you like fossils? Well, come to my backyard. I got all kinds of them," and I'll be there, you know, in a heartbeat, because you never know where it's going to lead. You never know the next rock that you turn over might just have something absolutely exquisite in it. And while 99% of what I find is fairly so-so kind of stuff, there's always that possibility that you might find something that's really cool. ¶¶
Welcome back to Between the Lines. And if you're just joining us, we are talking to Art Murphy, a fine art photographer who specializes in fossils.
Yeah, actually, one of the things that really struck me about the fossils and this tremendous arc of time is how it seems to me it's almost kind of a spiritual thing, in that it really kind of gives us a perspective on this life. Very similar to my love of astronomy. You know, you go out on a clear night and you look at the stars and you try to comprehend the vastness of the universe. And it does kind of put things in perspective for you. Similarly, as you look back in time, going all the way out in the further reaches of the universe, you're going back to time frames that are not too different in many ways from when these fossils were around. It kind of helps when the day-to-day stuff can get a little bit under your skin. You know, you can just say, well, this isn't even a blip. And it just kind of helps you to ride through whatever kind of malady you're having to contend with on any given day.
Now, you exhibit. You do this for yourself, or do you make...
Well, I do care to share it. As an artist, of course. I've got shows coming up, which are really exciting. The first show was a little more than 3 years ago. I had been working on the fossils probably for at least a couple of 2-3 years before that, but none of it was really ready to bring out. And since I am a photographer and I do other things, I do a lot of architectural work, urban landscape, rural landscape, things like that. So I've always been showing. And this project 3 years ago came, was time to start to break it out and show it. And it's been quite a wonderful experience to see what has happened and how it's grown in those 3 years. I had a one-man show at the Museum of the Earth up in Ithaca. I guess it was a little over a year ago. And just last November, I was in an international competition with one of the drawer series, a gastropod, that took me to Paris, which was very cool. And the most exciting thing right now is that I'm scheduled for a solo show at the Museum of Natural History in Florence, Italy, in September.
How did they find you?
Well, let me just say, first of all, I get goosebumps every time I say that. I
mean, yes.
This is the home of Leonardo. And there's actually been some healthy speculation that some of the pieces that are in the collection that I photographed in Florence might very well have come from his own hands. So, you know, it didn't get much better than that. How it happened was my partner Cindy and I were on a trip, I guess it's almost 2 years ago, to Italy. And one of the things that I've learned to do over the course of time, before we go anywhere, whether it's, down the street, over to the next county or another country, I like to prep a little bit. The worst thing in the world to have happen is to come back from a trip and go, oh my God, there was something really cool there and I missed it. So of course I Google right away, you know, where I'm going, and start to look into fossils and such, and see if there's something to make additionally out of the trip. In that particular case, I had discovered that the Natural History Museum of Florence had a geologist and paleontologist running that division. And since we were going to be in Florence for a week, I contacted them in advance, sent them some of the articles that had been written on me and my website and the like, and said I would love to have the opportunity to just introduce myself and say, hello, might you have the time? And I met with them, and they were just the sweetest, loveliest, most delightful people. In fact, I find that often with the people who I meet, various geologists and paleontologists, who get off on what I'm doing because they've never seen anything like it. And we strike up a very nice rapport. I was always unsure how they would react to it because these are not specimen type images. You know, I take liberties. They took us on a tour of the back rooms, where, of course, that's where all the cool stuff goes on at museums, all the stuff that's hidden away.
Well, that's good to know.
Well, many of, particularly with fossils and things like that, the collections serve a greater purpose for research than anything else. And some fine collections may have millions of pieces, but most of the time they're going to sit in the drawers. Seldom do they get any sort of square footage on the museum floor, because the museum floors are usually taken up with sexier stuff, you know, like tyrannosauruses and, you know, vertebrate animals. So it's a real treat to get behind the scenes and look in the drawers and poke around. Anyway, we had a lovely meeting there. They showed me around, and at the end of it, I just really couldn't contain myself. And I said, might it be at all possible just to take a few pictures? Stefano, the paleontologist there, said, well, come back tomorrow and we'll set something up for you. I had no idea what that would mean. I got there at 9:30, like he requested, and said to him, you will have to throw me out, because I will use up every available second that you're going to give me. So please tell me up front, how much time do I have? And thank you again. And he looked at his watch and said, well, I'm going to be here all day, so you got till 4:30. And I proceeded to photograph as much of their collection as I could in that period of time. And when I was done, as we were saying our goodbyes, they said, you know, we would really love to see the work. We might be able to work out a show. I was just beside myself. And whether or not it was going to happen was almost immaterial, because it was the gesture that was so sweet. Over time, and it took a while, and I got word, I guess it was in December, that they got a date for the show, and they're excited. And I'm more than excited. In fact, one of the coolest parts of it is that they really understood what it is that I try to do with my work, and they want to do something with it similar. And that is, as a photographer, you focus on different things that really kind of pique your interest. And hopefully there's a certain universality to that, that, you know, if you think it's kind of cool, then there's a reason why other people might want to take a look at it. And there's so much about our existence and about life with these old objects, or these former beings, if you will, from this long ago period, that people just walk by and have no sense of at all. That if they were to stop and take a look at the picture and say, whoa, how cool is that? Maybe that'll spark a little bit of an interest to just explore just another little aspect of the world around them. May not even be fossils, but just, you know, just opening up minds and eyes and awareness. And they feel the very same way, so much so that part of my exhibit in Florence will also be that they're opening up the back rooms that have never had people, you know, it's never been open to the public, because they want to hopefully use my photographs as a springboard to turn visitors to the museum on to how beautiful some of this stuff is.
So what's in the back rooms then?
Oh, just endless rows of cabinets, glass cabinets filled with fossils from all over the world.
So it's a fossil fest. A fossil fest in Florence, sorry.
Well, in fact, the joke that we have, we Cindy and I had come to Florence from Rome, where we spent just a few days, and it was the first time I had seen the Sistine Chapel. And just the overwhelming power and beauty of it had me in tears. It was so wonderful. And here we are a week later in Florence, and they throw open the door to this back room with just, it looks exactly like you would imagine it, you know, 18th century cabinets, you know, spindly wood and glass. And when Elisabetta opened up the door, I just kind of gasped and I said, my God, this must be the Sistine Chapel of Fossils. I think I was in from that point on. Yeah, and they loved it. And we, you know, we struck a chord. So it's been going well ever since.
Well, I congratulations. I think it just sounds absolutely fabulous. Is it a solo show?
Yes. In fact, it's going to take place in two rooms in the museum. One room will be images from their collection that I photographed, and the other room, it will be other fossils that I've shot from all over the place, here in particular local stuff as opposed to museums. I have shot at a number of other museums. And that's been one of the other interesting little side trips that this mm-hmm. world of fossils has provided me. And in a funny sort of a way, what I do when I go to a museum and go back into their storage areas is not too different than what I do when I'm walking a dry creek bed. You know, you're turning over all these rocks yeah. to find something that speaks yeah. to you, and you take some pictures. These things are locked away so no one ever sees them except an occasional researcher. So for all intent and purpose, they might as well still be in the ground.
You're kind of bringing these fossils back to life and making them sexy again, making them cool.
Well, I would like to. Yeah. I mean, I find it that way, you know, but then as I told my son a number of years ago when I first started to do this, I said, you know, the people down the road are really starting to worry about this goofy old guy who keeps walking out of the woods with bags of rocks. So
what did your son think about you taking up with fossils, as it were?
Oh, he loves it. He supports it. He grew up around here, and funny thing is, when he was a boy growing up in Woodstock, went to the Children's Center, and part of their education was to go out on little nature walks and fossil walks. And I remember bumping into them at the time with him, but it never really registered. You know, things have to hit at the right time and place before they really register the way you want them to, you know. So
just to change subject a little bit, how did you end up here? I mean, I know that you've had a somewhat peripatetic career.
I started out as a locomotive engineer. I ran coal and freight trains over the Continental Divide. Did that for about 6 or 7 years. But at the same time, I maintained a painting studio and wanted to always stay in that realm.
Where are you from originally?
I was born and raised in the Bronx. I guess when I was in junior high school, moved to the Midwest, went to college out in Colorado, and moved to New York in 1980, where I began working as a freelance photographer.
And you worked in advertising, did you not?
Some. Well, that's what first brought me there, was a job with a medium-sized ad agency. This was 1980, 82. It was at a time of major advertising consolidations, so it got sucked up by some big house, and I was out freelancing, driving a cab at night, and hustling my portfolio around during the daytime. Did a lot of editorial and corporate photography. At the same time, always managed to find time to work on my own personal projects, of which there were some interesting ones. I was one of the last photographers, I believe, onto Ellis Island before they began the massive renovations, and had a wonderful experience doing that. Having grandparents on both sides of the family pass through Ellis Island, that was kind of a cool thing early on. You know, you could really feel something about the place, especially when you were walking around in the back buildings where no one is really allowed now, but I had the permission at the time, and it was a really wonderful experience. So I've done some of that. I did a wonderful year-long project for the Metropolitan Museum of Art. They were a client of mine for a good while. And that project was a four-season study of the cloisters up in northern Manhattan, which was really a delight. How I got up here, my son and his mother lived up here from the time he was about 3 years old. So I was back and forth from the city for all of these years. Eventually made my way to spending more and more time up here and less time down there, until I could finally jettison the whole city experience and look at where I landed. You know, couldn't have worked out better.
Is there ever a danger of you getting, shall we say, fossilized in your art? By that I mean you kind of get stale. I mean, what inspires you? What challenges you?
Well, yeah, let me say first that, you know, like any other artist, or I guess anybody doing anything, it's real easy to get stale, especially if you figure out a way to make it real easy. I guess what really inspires me with the fossils is that every day is pretty much a new adventure. You know, I mean, it sounds really geeky, but if I carry some nice big heavy pieces, sandstone, back to my studio here, there's a real excitement in not knowing what's in it. And if you crack it just the right way, something beautiful, just very well defined and wonderfully delineated fossil that's like I say, nearly 400 million years old, is finally seeing the light of day. It's kind of a cool thing. I like shooting these images or shooting these fossils in a pretty plain and straightforward way and see where they kind of take me. I mean, I have certain techniques that I do because it's what I do and what I've developed, but it's just really, it's kind of a dialogue, you know. It's kind of like being at in front of a painting, you know. You throw some paint on the canvas and kind of let it talk back to you to kind of figure out where you want to go next. And I kind of do that with the computer in Photoshop and see where it goes. I'm also shooting other things, you know, so it's not like, there was a period where I was so obsessed where I had stopped shooting everything else but fossils. But, you know, that's starting to kind of mellow a little, and there are other things out there that are drawing a lot of attention to me. So, you know, they call out and I go take pictures. It's a pretty simple life.
Is there anyone out there who's doing anything at all similar? Any other fossil photographers out there?
Not to my knowledge at all. In fact, that's one of the things that I hear oftentimes from some of the paleontologists and geologists who see my work or who I run into. They've never seen anything like it. And in fact, one of the nicest compliments I ever got was from a pretty well-respected paleontologist who said of my work that I made it look like the way they make him feel. You know, and he's a scientist, may not have the ability to explain, you know, the aesthetic sort of feelings or what have you. And he said, yeah, these pictures, this is how I feel when I look at the stuff. So if I'm able to do that to someone who's very steeped in the knowledge and understanding of that, then yeah, I've accomplished something really nice.
It's a pretty good day, right?
Yeah, many times over. Yeah, and at the same time, if I have a little kid who looks at it and says, wow, this little thing here, you made into that. Wow, how neat, right?
You also clearly inform your work quite a lot with astronomy. You've got Fred Hoyle on astronomy over there. You've got Magritte over there, and is there any room for a conventional dark room here, or is that sort
Completely? Why would I want that? Why in God's name would I want something like that? We don't take steps. I'm not a Luddite. We don't take steps backwards. We go forward.
No, but I think, always think there's something romantic about a dark room.
No, there was never
people, like hanging up the.
There was never any romance to it. Did you ever have to smell those chemicals?
Yes,
they were dreadful.
Yeah.
I never cared for being in there. And when I was working commercially down in the city, you seldom had the opportunity to get in the dark room because you were always running to the next assignment. So you had people at labs handle all your work for you. When the digital world broke out for us, I was delighted. I couldn't get enough of it. I started with Photoshop 2, one of the earliest versions of Photoshop. And I was different from a lot of other photographers in that I really embraced it. I mean, it's like, it was just a perfect blend of painting and photography because so much of Photoshop, which I learned by my work as a commercial retoucher, is really all about painting. I mean, there is, believe it or not, a certain sensuality to painting and making beautiful masks that allow you to control what it is that you're doing. So this was like a tremendous leap forward. And I was always really puzzled by my fellow photographers, particularly back in the early days, you know, the ones who would be running around hollering, oh, film will never die, and, you know, all that kind of stuff. I had always thought that photographers as a lot were generally a bit more adventurous, you know, willing to embrace the unknown. But man, there were so many guys who had they were so stodgy, you know, they were just, you know, stuck in cement, fighting and kicking. And so many of them today, even, they know maybe the rudiments of Photoshop or Photoshop Lite, and they can do enough to get by, or quite frankly, oftentimes, just enough to screw things up to have to pay a retoucher to come in and fix for them. So, you know, I could translate traditional photography into the digital world, it kind of came naturally to me. You know, the zone system being replaced by your curves and your... I could get technical on it, but there's no need. But anyway, yeah.
Well, we might have some photographers listening, so why not?
To me, it was just a real simple translation. The bottom line is what your final usage is for the work and what the final output is. And when you get what you want, that's all you really need. I mean, I had an opportunity a number of years ago when I was running a boutique retouching and printing operation in the city to do some work with Robert Frank, who I think is one of the most important photographers of the 20th century. Wonderful, sweet man. And
just to remind our listeners, what exactly did he photograph?
Well, he did that seminal piece in, I think it was 1948, called The Americans, which really transformed the way photography was viewed, the way photographers took pictures. It was a major, major moment in the history of photography. Anyway, I had the opportunity to do some of his earliest digital printing for some retrospective shows. And it was really cool because he came into the back room and the printing room, and you know, we would go over everything. And I remember one day in particular, he came in with an assistant, and his assistant was just kind of zooming around and, well, we can't do this here, we got to do this, and blah, 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 you know, on and on. And she was just really frantic about everything, and Robert was sitting back, just taking the whole thing in, and constantly being asked, you know, what to do here, what to do there, which you just kind of pass on. And finally, he leans over to me and he says, "Art," he says, "you know, in the end, this is just a picture." You know? This is like one of the most famous photographers of all time.
Oh,
he's really the guy giving me the true perspective on it. You know, yes, in the end, picture. It's just a picture. Don't get crazy about it.
So I wonder if that would be in his tombstone in the end, or just a picture.
I don't know, and I don't know how many times he's repeated that either.
Yeah, right.
But you know, it's something that I kind of keep in mind. Kind of gives you a real healthy perspective. None of this stuff is sacred, you know. It's just what you do.
What do you use camera wise?
I use all different kinds of things, because really the more important thing is having the image to work with. You know, if I have a pocket point and shoot, I'll use that. If all I have is my phone, I'll use that, although I don't like to rely on that exclusively. I have some Canon equipment. Prior to working on the fossils, I was still using film, and I was shooting with a view camera. And, of course, before that, you know, all the traditional Nikons hanging around your neck and that sort of thing. But these days, there are so many wonderful little cameras that are out there that can do amazing things for you. And I don't necessarily mean all the little filters and all the little tricks and all of that stuff. But, you know, optically, a little $200 point and shoot can give you exquisite work. I mean, it's a matter of how you use what you have rather than what it is that you have.
Now, and the most important thing of all, which is, where can people see your work?
My website is www.artmurphy.com, and it shows my fossils, some of its variations. Probably sure needs to be updated. I'm always a little bit slow on that. And also some of the other stuff that I do, including some of the various urban architecture, industrial archaeological sort of things that I used to get involved in and still do. I have a blog, a weekly blog that I'm very proud of, called artandfossils.wordpress.com. And it's a little bit diaristic, but it kind of keeps me going. Always there's something new to talk about, some new work that I'm dealing with. And so I can throw 10 or 15 images up with a little bit of conversation. It so happens that on the 20th of this month, Saturday, I am part of a group show at the Carrie Haddad Gallery in Hudson, and that will be some of the architectural work, and I'm real excited about that. It's my first opportunity to show with Carrie, and she's an absolute delight, so
Yeah, I think Carrie is well known to the radio station, yeah, and she's also a big supporter of WGXC.
Yeah, she's a big supporter of a lot of things locally, and she's a great local resource, you know, local treasure. This summer, I have a one-man show up on Lake Champlain, all the way up at the very northern part on a little island called Isle La Motte, which has, if I remember correctly, the world's oldest known coral. Yeah, the coral bed. And I photographed that pretty extensively a year ago, so I'm having a solo show up there. And that'll be just a few weeks before we head off to Florence.
Wow, it's a fantastic summer coming up. Then.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm delighted. And I've got a lot of other things that are going on right now, other smaller shows or parts of shows, and not the least of which is going to be printing two complete solo shows. So I've got
Got your hands full.
Yeah, I got a lot to do. You know what? That's a good kind of problem to have, and I couldn't be more delighted.
Yeah. Plus, the seasons are changing. There'll be a lot to do outside.
Isn't it wonderful?
A lot more fossils to find.
Ever since the sun finally came out a few days ago, yeah, I can't stay still. So it's just wonderful to be out there. Yeah, good to be alive, you know.
Art Murphy, photographer. I just want to thank you so much for being on Between the Lines. It's been a real joy to have you on.
Well, thank you so much. It was a real pleasure to have you, and thank you.
Thank you. vision.
Welcome back to Between the Lines. I'm your host, Anne Forbes Cooper. My next guest, Nina Sklansky, is on a mission to reinvent the village of Catskill where she lives. Sklansky, a former copywriter and associate creative director at BBDO, one of the biggest ad agencies in the world, came up with the idea of creating a website and a marketing campaign to promote Catskill. So she began holding a series of weekly meetings at her home, to which she invited a group of stakeholders and friends. This evolved into a grassroots movement called the Catskill Action Team. And full disclosure, as a Catskill resident, I was one of those friends and stakeholders. Last week, the website catskillthevillage.com went live, part of a marketing campaign involving several new initiatives designed to promote Catskill. Okay, first of all, Nina, welcome to Between the Lines.
Thank you, Anne, and I'm delighted to be here.
I'd like to start by asking you, what exactly is the Catskill Action Team?
Catskill Action Team is a grassroots organization, kind of an ad hoc group of stakeholders in the village of Catskill who have either businesses or residences or both, full and part-time, and who are interested in seeing Catskill fulfill its promise.
Well, that begs the question, what exactly is Catskill's promise that you would like the Catskill Action Team to fulfill?
I think that we would like to see new businesses, thriving businesses that create jobs. We'd like to see our real estate market reinvigorated. We were doing really, really well for a few years there. And since the crash, of course, things have been pretty static. I think it's always important for municipalities to have fresh blood. I think that keeps things moving. And I think that there are basic challenges that we face.
Let me ask you, how did it come about?
During the crash, I was kind of sitting there in my house wondering what was to become of this place that we love and that we own properties in. And since my background is all advertising, I thought of possibly creating an ad campaign to get the word out to a market beyond a local one, because it always seems as if we're talking to ourselves. There's the Great Northern Catskills campaign, which is a countywide initiative, and it doesn't seem like it really is specific enough to Catskill, the village.
And I was just going to ask you to make the point that it is, in fact, Catskill, the village. It's not Catskill, the town.
Let me just say that the idea was to rebrand the village as a Hudson Valley riverfront village, because we're not, as the line says on the website, www.catskillthevillage.com, when you go there, you'll see that the theme line is not the Catskills, Catskill. That came about because there's tremendous confusion, whether it's realtors trying to sell property here or whether it's, you've probably had the experience yourself. You say, I live in Catskill, and people say, oh, the mountains. And it's not the mountains, and the mountains are fine, but it's a different thing entirely. So I think clarifying where we are, what we are, and the opportunity that we offer is important to our future in attracting new people here.
And again, just to make the point that what the Catskill Action Team has done so far is it's created a website called catskillthevillage.com. This wonderful website created by Nina.
Well, and that in itself was kind of a crazy process, because I'm by profession, a copywriter for advertising and a creative director, but I'm not a tech person. So the whole process, since we don't have, this is an entirely volunteer effort. So it wasn't about being able to hire a web designer or anything like that. So I had to learn how to use the program actually to create the site itself. At the site, you'll find the basic proposition, which is this is a great opportunity. And it highlights a lot of local assets that we've identified, presents some real estate opportunities, talks about the people that live here, and invites people to come take a look and see what they might create here.
Now, in addition to the website, can you talk about any of the initiatives coming up?
Well, we have initiatives that range from enhancing the way our streets look, cleaning up, garden initiatives. There's a program called Cultivate Catskill that was started by one of the people who was involved early on, Shelley Pulver. She discovered a program called America in Bloom that she's using to sort of implement a kind of a renaissance of gardens and plantings in Catskill to beautify things. Let me just say that the team itself, it's a loosely formed team. Everybody is a member, whether it's the photographers who provided photography for the website free of charge, to people like yourself who are providing your own form of expertise, whether it's doing this interview or helping with PR and media placement and stuff that we hope to be able to make.
How is this funded, Nina?
We are entirely dependent upon your donations. So we are asking that, and that's another way of becoming a member of the Catskill Action Team. You don't actually have to be writing anything or photographing anything. We need funding to be able to extend this campaign as far as we can. It could mean placing ads, creating collateral materials, doing billboards and stuff. All of that incurs real costs, and so we are asking for donations.
And if someone wants to give a donation, how do they do that?
You make out a check to Village of Catskill, and in the memo line, say, indicate Catskill Action Team or CAT, and you mail it to Catskill Action Team at 18 Liberty Street, Catskill, New York, 12414. The reason the checks are made out to the Village of Catskill is that by doing so, we can make your donations tax deductible. The money is not going to the village. They're just sort of managing it. Everything's entirely transparent. There's records kept on both ends and, full accounting of what's been collected.
And if someone just wants to help out or volunteer or get involved or they want to know more about this, what do you suggest they do?
You can write info@catskillthevillage.com. Email. Yeah.
I don't think anybody writes anymore. Yeah. Send us a letter.
Send us an email there. And that's, one thing. The best thing right now, we need money. I mean, we've kind of gotten through the first phase of getting the website launched, got a Facebook page up, and then we take it from there, depending on how much money we get. And then the individual initiatives will be asking for funding, too. But right now, we're concerned about media.
Nina, I'd like to thank you for being on Between the Lines.
And I'd like to thank you for having me on.
And you have been listening to Between the Lines. I'm your host, Anne Forbes Cooper. The music you were listening to was my theme tune, which is Sarah Bareilles's Between the Lines. And next up, we had Johan de Mijge, and I'm sorry if I mispronounced that, with Songs from the Catskills. And Johan is a local performer. He lives in Socrates. And then we had Beck reimagines David Bowie's Sound and Vision. Thanks as always for listening. I will be back next month, that's May, a usual time, the third Thursday of every month at 2 p.m.